That implied that the nutrients contained within carbohydrates are essential for human health? Certain nutrients are considered essential in our diet because our bodies cannot synthesize them. Without dietary sources of these nutrients, we suffer ill health. There are essential fatty acids, such as the omega-3 and omega-6 fats, and essential amino acids, such as phenylalanine, valine, and threonine. But there are no essential carbohydrates and no essential sugars. Those are not required for survival. Carbohydrates are just long chains of sugars. There is nothing intrinsically nutritious about them. Low-carbohydrate diets that focus on removing refined grains and sugars should be inherently healthier. Perhaps unbalanced, but not unhealthy. Another criticism leveled at the low-carb diet is that much of the initial weight loss that dieters experience is water, which is true. High carbohydrate intake increases insulin, and insulin stimulates the kidney to reabsorb water. Lowering insulin, therefore, causes excretion of the excess water. But why is this bad? Who wants swollen ankles? By the late 1990s, as the new low-carbohydrate approach fused with the prevailing low-fat religion, the Atkins diet version 2.0 was born, a low-carb, low-fat, and high-protein approach. Where the original Atkins diet was high in fat, this new bastard diet was high in protein. Most high-protein foods also tend to be high-fat, too. But this new approach called for lots of boneless, skinless chicken breasts and egg white omelets. Once you tired of that, there were protein bars and shakes. A high-protein diet made many worry about potential kidney damage. High-protein diets are not recommended for those with chronic kidney disease, since the ability to deal with the breakdown products of proteins is impaired. However, in people with normal kidney functions, there are no concerns. Several recent studies have concluded that a high-protein diet was not associated with any noticeable harmful effects on kidney function. The concerns about kidney damage were overblown. The biggest problem with high-protein diets was that they didn't really work for weight loss. But why not? The reasoning seems solid. Insulin causes weight gain. Reducing refined carbohydrates lowers blood sugar and insulin. But all foods cause insulin secretion. The Atkins version 2.0 approach assumed that dietary proteins do not raise insulin since they do not raise blood sugars. This notion was incorrect. The insulin response to specific foods can be measured and ranked. The glycemic index measures the rise in blood sugar in response to a standard portion of food. The insulin index, created by Suzanne Holt in 1997, measures the rise in insulin in response to a standard proportion of food, and it turns out to be quite different from the glycemic index. Not surprisingly, refined carbohydrates cause a surge in insulin levels. What was astounding was that the dietary proteins could cause a similar surge. The glycemic index does not consider protein or fats at all because they do not raise glucose, and that approach essentially ignores the fattening effects of two out of the three major macronutrients. Insulin can increase independently of blood sugar. With carbohydrates, there is a very tight correlation between blood glucose and insulin levels. But overall, blood glucose was responsible for only 23% of the variability in the insulin response. The vast majority of the insulin response, 77%, has nothing to do with blood sugars. Insulin, not glucose, drives weight gain. And that changes everything. This point is precisely where glycemic index diets failed. They targeted the glucose response with the assumption that insulin mirrored glucose. But this is not the case. You could lower the glucose response, but you didn't necessarily lower the insulin response. In the end, the insulin response is what matters. What factors, other than glucose, determine the insulin response? Consider the incretin effect and cephalic phase. The incretin effect and the cephalic phase. Blood sugar is often assumed to be the only stimulus for insulin secretion. But we've long known this was false. In 1966, studies showed that oral or intravenous administration of the amino acid leucine causes insulin secretion. This inconvenient fact was promptly forgotten until it was rediscovered decades later. In 1986, Dr. Michael Nauck noticed something very unusual. A subject's blood sugar response is identical whether a dose of glucose is given by mouth or intravenously. But, despite the same level of blood sugar, the subject's insulin levels differ greatly. Remarkably, the insulin response to oral glucose was much more powerful. Oral administration almost never has a stronger effect than intravenous. Intravenous infusions have 100% bioavailability, meaning that all of the infusion is delivered directly into the blood. When given by mouth, many medicines are incompletely absorbed or partially deactivated by the liver before reaching the bloodstream. For this reason, intravenous delivery tends to be much more effective. However, in this situation, the opposite was true. Oral glucose was far, far better at stimulating insulin. Furthermore, this mechanism had nothing to do with the blood sugar level. This phenomenon had not previously been described. Intensive research efforts revealed that the stomach itself produces hormones called incretins that increase insulin secretion. Since the intravenous glucose bypasses the stomach, there is no incretin effect. The incretin effect may account for 50% to 70% of the insulin secretion after oral glucose intake. Rather than simply being a mechanism for food absorption and excretion, the gastrointestinal tract, with its nerve cells, receptors, and hormones, functions almost like a second brain. The two human incretin hormones described so far are glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, and glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, GIP. Both hormones are deactivated by the hormone dipeptidyl peptidase 4. The incretins are secreted by the stomach and small intestine in response to food. Both GLP-1 and GIP increase insulin release by the pancreas. Fats, amino acids, and glucose all stimulate incretin release and thus increase insulin levels. Even non-nutritive sweeteners, which have no calories at all, can stimulate the insulin response. Sucralose in humans, for example, raises the insulin level 22% higher. The incretin effect starts within minutes of ingestion of nutrients into the stomach and peaks at roughly 60 minutes. The incretins have other important effects as well. They delay emptying of stomach contents into the small intestine, which slows down glucose absorption. The cephalic phase is another pathway of insulin secretion independent of glucose. The body anticipates food as soon as it goes in your mouth and long before nutrients hit the stomach. For example, swishing a sucrose or saccharin solution around your mouth and spitting it out will increase your insulin level. While the importance of the cephalic phase is unknown, it highlights the significant fact that there are multiple glucose-independent pathways of insulin release. The discovery of these new pathways was electrifying. The incretin effect explains how fatty acids and amino acids also play a role in stimulating insulin. All foods, not just carbohydrates, stimulate insulin. Thus, all foods can cause weight gain. and hence we get major confusion with calories. High-protein foods can cause weight gain, not due to their caloric content, but rather to their insulin-stimulating effects. If carbohydrates are not the only or even the major stimulus to insulin, then restricting carbohydrates may not always be as beneficial as we believed. Substituting insulin-stimulating proteins for insulin-stimulating carbohydrates produces no net benefit. Dietary fat, though, tends to have the weakest insulin-stimulating effect. Dairy, meat, and the insulin index. Proteins differ greatly in their capacity to stimulate insulin, with dairy products in particular being potent stimuli. Dairy also shows the largest discrepancy between the blood glucose and insulin effect. It scores extremely low on the glycemic index, 15 to 30, but very high on the insulin index, 90 to 98. Milk does contain sugars, predominantly in the form of lactose. However, when tested, pure lactose has minimal effect on either the glycemic or insulin indexes. Milk contains two main types of dairy protein, casein, 80%, and whey, 20%. Cheese contains mostly casein. Whey is the byproduct left over from the curds in cheese making. Bodybuilders frequently use whey protein supplements because it is high in branched chain amino acids, felt to be important in muscle formation. Dairy protein, particularly whey, is responsible for raising insulin levels even higher than whole wheat bread, due largely to the incretin effect. Whey protein supplementation increased GLP-1 by 298%. The insulin index shows great variability, but nevertheless, there are some general patterns. Increasing carbohydrate consumption leads to increased insulin secretion. This relationship forms the basis of many low-carbohydrate and glycemic index diets, and also explains the well-known propensity of starchy and sugary foods to cause obesity. Fatty foods can also stimulate insulin, but pure fats, such as olive oil, do not stimulate insulin or glucose. However, few foods are eaten as pure fat. It may be that the protein component of fatty foods derives the insulin response. It is also interesting that fat tends to have a flat dose response curve. Higher and higher amounts of fat do not stimulate any greater insulin response. Despite the higher caloric value of fat, it stimulates insulin less than carbohydrates or protein. The surprise here is dietary protein. The insulin response is highly variable. While vegetable proteins raise insulin minimally, whey protein and meat, including seafood, cause significant insulin secretion. But are dairy and meat fattening? That question is complicated. The incretin hormones have multiple effects, only one of which is to stimulate insulin. Incretins also have a major effect on satiety. Satiety. Incretin hormones play an important role in the control of gastric emptying. The stomach normally holds food and mixes it with stomach acid before slowly discharging the contents. GLP-1 causes stomach emptying to significantly slow. Absorption of nutrients also slows, resulting in lower blood glucose and insulin levels. Furthermore, this effect creates a sensation of satiety that we experience as being full. A 2010 study compared the effect of four different proteins, eggs, turkey, tuna, and whey protein, on participants' insulin levels. As expected, whey resulted in the highest insulin levels. 4 hours afterward, the participants were treated to a buffet lunch. The whey group ate substantially less than the other groups. The whey protein suppressed their appetites and increased their satiety. In other words, those subjects were full. See figure 17.1. So the incretin hormones produce two opposing effects. Increased insulin promotes weight gain, but increased satiety suppresses it, which is consistent with personal experience. Animal proteins tend to cause you to feel fuller for longer, with whey having the greatest effect. Compare two calorically equal portions of food, a small steak versus a large sugared soda. Which keeps you full longer? The clear winner is the steak. It creates more satiety. The steak just sits in your stomach. You are feeling the incretin effect of slowing the emptying of stomach contents. The soda, however, does not sit in your stomach for long, and you quickly become hungry again. These two opposing effects, insulin promotes weight gain, but satiety promotes weight loss, cause a maddening debate about meat and dairy. The important question is this: which effect is more powerful? It is possible that the specific incretin stimulated may be important in determining weight gain or loss. For example, selective stimulation of GLP-1, as with a drug such as exenatide, produces weight loss, as the resulting satiety effects outweigh the weight gaining effects. Therefore, we must consider each protein separately, since there is considerable variation in the effect of each on weight. The main dietary proteins studied are dairy and meat, and we have two main considerations here: the incretin effect and the portion of dietary protein. Meat. Traditionally, meat consumption was thought to cause weight gain because meat is high in protein, fat, and calories. However, more recently, many considered it to cause weight loss because it is low in carbohydrate. Which is true? This is a difficult question, since the only data available are association studies, which are open to interpretation and cannot establish causation. The European Prospective Investigation into Cancer and Nutrition study was a massive European prospective cohort study started in 1992, encompassing 521,448 volunteers from 10 countries. After 5 years of follow-up, findings showed that total meat, red meat, poultry, and processed meats were all significantly associated with weight gain, even after adjustment for total caloric intake. Eating 3 extra servings of meat per day is associated with an extra pound in weight gain over 1 year, even after controlling for calories. In North America, combined data is available from the Nurses Health Studies 1 and 2 and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. Both processed and unprocessed red meat were associated with weight gain. Each additional daily serving of meat increased body weight by approximately 1 pound, 0.45 kilograms. This effect even exceeded the weight-increasing effect of sweets and desserts. So, on balance, the weight-increasing effect seems predominant here. There are some possible contributing factors. First, most beef is now raised in a feedlot and fed grain. Cows are ruminants that naturally eat grass. This change in their diet may change the character of the meat. Wild animal meat is similar to grass-fed beef, but not to grain-fed beef. Feedlot cattle require large doses of antibiotics. Farm-raised fish also have little in common with wild fish. Farm-raised fish eat pellets that often contain grains and other cheap substitutes for a fish's natural diet. Second, while we understand the benefits of eating whole foods, we do not apply this knowledge to meat. We eat only the muscle meats rather than the entire animal, thereby risking overconsumption of the muscle meat. We generally discard most of the organ meats, cartilage and bones, which is analogous to drinking the juice of a fruit but discarding the pulp. Yet bone broth, liver, kidney, and blood are all parts of the traditional human diets. Traditional staples like steak and kidney pie, blood sausage, and liver have disappeared. Ethnic foods such as tripe, pork bung, congealed pig's blood, oxtail, and beef tongue still survive. The organ meats tend to be the fattiest parts of the animal. By focusing almost exclusively on the muscles of animals for food, we are preferentially eating protein rather than fat. Dairy. The story with dairy is entirely different. Despite the fact that its consumption causes big increases in insulin levels, large observation studies do not link dairy to weight gain. If anything, dairy protects against weight gain, as found in the Swedish mammography cohort. In particular, whole milk, sour milk, cheese, and butter were associated with less weight gain, but not low-fat milk. The 10-year prospective Cardia study found that the highest intake of dairy is associated with the lowest incidence of obesity and type 2 diabetes. Other large population studies confirmed this association. The data from the Nurses' Health Studies and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study shows that overall, average weight gain over any 4-year period was 3.35 pounds, 1.5 kilograms, pretty close to 1 pound per year. Milk and cheese were essentially weight neutral. Yogurt seemed to be particularly slimming, possibly due to the fermentation process. Butter did have a small effect on weight gain. Why is there such a difference between dairy and meat? One difference is portion size. Eating more meat is easy. You could eat a large steak or half a roast chicken or a large bowl of chili. However, increasing dairy protein to the same degree is more difficult. Can you eat a huge slab of cheese for dinner? How about drink several gallons of milk? Eat 2 large tubs of yogurt for lunch? Hardly. It is difficult to significantly increase dairy proteins without resorting to whey protein shakes and other such artificial foods. An extra glass of milk a day doesn't cut it. Therefore, even if dairy proteins are particularly good at stimulating insulin, the small portions do not make a large overall difference. By eating large amounts of skim milk, lean meat, and protein bars, Atkins enthusiasts were unintentionally stimulating their insulin to the same degree as before. Substituting large amounts of lean, often processed meat for carbohydrates was not a winning strategy. Reducing sugar and white bread was good advice, but replacing them with luncheon meats was not. Furthermore, with increased meal frequency, the protection of the incretin effect was diminished. The hormonal obesity theory. Now we can modify the hormonal obesity theory to include the incretin effect to provide the complete picture, as illustrated in Figure 17.2. Animal protein is highly variable but comes with the protective effect of satiety. And we shouldn't ignore the protective power of the incretin effect. The slowing of gastric motility increases satiety so that we feel more full and therefore eat less at the next meal, or even skip a meal altogether to allow ourselves time to digest. This behavior is instinctive. When children are not hungry, they will not eat. Wild animals also show the same restraint. But we've trained ourselves to ignore our own feelings of satiety so that we will eat when the time comes, whether we are hungry or not. Here's a small tip for weight loss, one that should be obvious but is not. If you are not hungry, don't eat. Your body is telling you that you should not be eating. After indulging in a large meal, such as we do at Thanksgiving, we feel paranoid about skipping the next meal because of an irrational fear that missing even a single meal will wreck our metabolism. So we circumvent the protective effect of incretins by rigidly scheduling 3 meals a day with snacks, come hell or high water. There is still more to learn. Blood glucose accounts for only 23% of the insulin response. Dietary fats and proteins only accounts for another 10%. Close to 67% of the insulin response is still unknown, which is tantalizingly close to the 70% contribution to obesity that is inherited, as described in Chapter 2. Other suspected factors include presence of dietary fiber, an elevated amylose-amylopectin ratio, preserved botanical integrity, whole foods, presence of organic acids, fermentation, addition of vinegar, acetic acid, and addition of chili peppers, capsaicin. Simplistic arguments that carbs make you fat, or calories make you fat, or red meat makes you fat, or sugar makes you fat, do not fully capture the complexity of human obesity. The hormonal obesity theory provides a framework for understanding the interaction of disease. All foods stimulate insulin. Thus, all foods could be fattening, and that's where the calorie confusion emerges. Since all foods could be fattening, we imagined that all foods could be measured in a common unit, the calorie. But the calorie was the wrong unit. Calories do not cause obesity. Instead, insulin is responsible. Without a framework for understanding insulin, it was impossible to understand the inconsistencies of the epidemiologic evidence. The low-fat caloric reduction approach was a proven failure. The high-protein approach was subsequently proved a failure. And so many returned to the failed caloric reduction approach. But a new approach known as the paleo diet, sometimes referred to as the caveman diet or the original human diet, was gaining strength. Only foods that were available in Paleolithic or ancient times are to be consumed. Dieters avoid all processed foods, added sugars, dairy, grains, vegetable oils, sweeteners, and alcohols. However, fruits, vegetables, nuts, seeds, spices, herbs, meats, seafood, and eggs are all acceptable. The paleo diet does not limit carbohydrates, proteins, or fat. Instead, the consumption of processed foods is curtailed. Remember that the single defining characteristic of the Western diet is food processing, not macronutrient content. The toxicity lies not in the food, but in the processing. The low-carb, high-fat, or low-carb, healthy-fat, LCHF diet is similar, maintaining a focus on real foods. The main difference is that the LCHF diet allows dairy products and is stricter on the fruits due to their carbohydrate content. The LCHF approach makes some sense, as dairy foods are generally not associated with weight gain. This factor allows for greater dietary choice and, hopefully, better long-term compliance. The paleo LCHF diet is based on the simple observation that humans can eat a wide variety of foods without becoming obese or developing diabetes. These foods can be eaten without counting calories, counting carbohydrates, or using food diaries, pedometers, or any other such artificial means. You simply eat when hungry and don't eat when full. However, the foods are all of an unprocessed nature and had been consumed by humans for thousands of years without causing illness. They had withstood the test of time. These are the foods that we should base our diets on. There are no intrinsically bad foods, only processed ones. The further you stray from real food, the more danger you are in. Should you eat protein bars? No. Should you eat meal replacements? No. Should you drink meal replacement shakes? Absolutely not. Should you eat processed meats, processed fats, or processed carbohydrates? No, no, and no. While we ideally would all eat grass-fed beef and organically raised strawberries, let's be real here. There will be times when we'll eat processed food because it is cheap, available, and, let's face it, delicious. Think ice cream. However, we have, over the centuries, developed other dietary strategies such as fasting to detoxify or cleanse ourselves. These strategies have been lost in the mists of time. We will rediscover these ancient secrets soon, but for now, stick to the real food. Natural foods contain significant amounts of saturated fats. This fact naturally leads to the questions: won't all these saturated fats clog up my arteries? Won't it lead to heart attacks? The short answer is no. But why not? That's the subject of the next chapter. Chapter 18. Fat phobia. It is now increasingly recognized that the low-fat campaign has been based on little scientific evidence and may have caused unintended health consequences. Harvard researchers Drs. Frank Hu and Walter Willett, 2001. One of the giants of modern nutritional science, Dr. Ansel Keys, 1904 to 2004, received his first PhD in oceanography and biology, and a second PhD in physiology from the University of Cambridge. He spent most of the rest of his career at the University of Minnesota, where he would play a dominant role in defining the current nutritional landscape. During World War II, Dr. Keys led the development of the K-rations, which would form the basis of military nutrition in the United States. He studied the effects of severe caloric restriction in the famous Minnesota starvation experiment, discussed in Chapter 3. However, his crowning achievement is considered to be the Seven Countries Study, a long-term observational study of diet and heart disease. In the post-World War II years, starvation and malnutrition were the major nutritional challenges. But Dr. Keys was struck by an odd inconsistency. Americans, despite far better nourishment, were suffering from rising rates of heart attack and stroke. In war-ravaged Europe, those rates remained low. In 1951, Dr. Keys noticed low rates of heart disease in Italian laborers. The Mediterranean diet, as he observed in Naples, was substantially lower in fat, 20% of calories, than the American diet of the period, approximately 45% of calories. Most striking, though, was the lower rate of consumption of animal foods and saturated fat. He hypothesized that high blood cholesterol levels caused heart disease and that the low dietary intake of fat was protective. In 1959, he published his dietary advice for the prevention of cardiovascular disease. Prominent among his recommendations were the following guidelines. Do not get fat. If you are fat, reduce. Easier said than done. Restrict saturated fats. The fats in beef, pork, lamb, sausages, margarine and solid shortenings, and the fats in dairy products. Prefer vegetable oils to solid fats, but keep total fats under 30% of your diet calories. These recommendations survived relatively intact and defined nutritional orthodoxy for the next half century. In 1977, they became enshrined in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. The main message, then, as now, is that all fat is bad, but saturated fats particularly so. Dietary fat was thought to clog up the arteries and cause heart attacks. The ambitious Seven Countries study compared rates of coronary disease with various diet and lifestyle factors across nations. By 1970, with 5 years' worth of data, the study had several main conclusions regarding fats. Cholesterol levels predicted heart disease risk. The amount of saturated fat in the diet predicted cholesterol levels. Monounsaturated fat protected against heart disease. The Mediterranean diet protected against heart disease. Significantly, total dietary fat was not correlated to heart disease. Rather, saturated fat was dangerous, but monounsaturated fats were protective. Dietary cholesterol was also not identified as a risk factor for heart disease. Heart disease is caused by atherosclerosis, the process by which arteries in the heart become narrowed and hardened by the buildup of plaque. But atherosclerosis is not simply the result of high cholesterol levels clogging arteries. Current opinion holds that plaque develops as a response to injury. The wall of the artery becomes damaged, resulting in inflammation, which in turn allows infiltration of cholesterol and inflammatory cells into artery walls, in addition to the proliferation of smooth muscle. The narrowing of the artery may cause chest pain, also called angina. When plaques rupture, a blood clot forms, which abruptly blocks the artery. The resulting lack of oxygen causes a heart attack. Heart attacks and strokes are predominantly inflammatory diseases rather than simply diseases of high cholesterol levels. This understanding, however, came much later. In the 1950s, it was imagined that cholesterol circulated and deposited on the arteries much like sludge in a pipe, hence the popular image of dietary fat clogging up the arteries. It was believed that eating saturated fats caused high cholesterol levels, and high cholesterol levels caused heart attacks. This series of conjectures became known as the diet-heart hypothesis. Diets high in saturated fats caused high blood cholesterol levels, which caused heart disease. The liver manufactures the overwhelming majority, 80%, of the blood cholesterol, with only 20% coming from diet. Cholesterol is often portrayed as some harmful, poisonous substance that must be eliminated, but nothing could be farther from the truth. Cholesterol is a key building block in the membranes that surround all the cells in our body. In fact, it's so vital that every cell in the body except the brain has the ability to make it. If you reduce cholesterol in your diet, your body will simply make more. The Seven Countries study had two major problems, although neither was very obvious at the time. First, it was a correlation study. As such, its findings could not prove causation. Correlation studies are dangerous because it is very easy to mistakenly draw causal conclusions. However, they are often the only source of long-term data available. It is always important to remember that they can only generate hypotheses to be tested in more rigorous trials. The heart benefit of the low-fat diet was not proven false until 2006 with the publication of the Women's Health Initiative Dietary Modification Trial and the Low-Fat Dietary Pattern and Risk of Cardiovascular Disease Study. some 30 years after the low-fat approach became enshrined in nutritional lore. By that time, like a supertanker, the low-fat movement had gained so much momentum that it was impossible to turn it aside. The association of heart disease and saturated fat intake is not proof that saturated fat causes heart disease. Some recognized this fatal flaw immediately and argued against making dramatic dietary recommendations based on such flimsy evidence. The seemingly strong link between heart disease and saturated fat consumption was forged with quotation and repetition, not with scientifically sound evidence. There were many possible interpretations of the seven countries study. Animal protein, saturated fats, and sugar were all correlated to heart disease. Higher sucrose intake could just as easily have explained the correlation to heart disease, as Dr. Keyes himself had acknowledged. It is also possible that higher intakes of animal protein, saturated fats, and sugar are all merely markers of industrialization. Countries with higher levels of industrialization tended to eat more animal products, meat and dairy, and also tended to have higher rates of heart disease. Perhaps it was the processed foods. All of these hypotheses could have been generated from the same data. But what we got was the diet heart hypothesis and the resulting low-fat crusade. The second major problem was the inadvertent triumph of nutritionism, a term popularized by the journalist and author Michael Pollan. Rather than discussing individual foods, spinach, beef, ice cream, nutritionism reduced foods to only three macronutrients, carbohydrates, proteins, and fats. They were then subdivided further as saturated and unsaturated fats, trans fats, simple and complex carbohydrates, etc. This sort of simplistic analysis does not capture the hundreds of nutrients and phytochemicals in foods, all of which affect our metabolism. Nutritionism ignores the complexity of food science and human biology. An avocado, for instance, is not simply 88% fat, 16% carbohydrate, and 5% protein with 4.9 grams of fiber. This sort of nutritional reductionism is how avocados became classified for decades as a bad food due to their high fat content, only to be reclassified today as a superfood. Nutritionally, a piece of butterscotch candy cannot be reasonably compared to kale simply because both contain equal amounts of carbohydrate. Nutritionally, a teaspoon of trans-fat-laden margarine cannot be reasonably compared to an avocado simply because both contain equal amounts of fats. Dr. Keyes made the unnoticed and unintentional claim that all saturated fats, all unsaturated fats, all dietary cholesterol, etc., are the same. This fundamental error led to decades of flawed research and understanding. Nutritionism fails to consider foods as individuals, each with its own particular good and bad traits. Kale is not the same nutritionally as white bread, even though both contain carbohydrates. These two fundamental but subtle errors of judgment led to the widespread acceptance of the diet-heart hypothesis, even though the evidence supporting it was shaky at best. Most natural animal fats are chiefly composed of saturated fats. In contrast, vegetable oils, such as corn, are chiefly omega-6 polyunsaturated fatty acids. After remaining relatively stable from 1900 to 1950, animal fat consumption began a relentless decline. The dialogue began to change in the late 1990s due to popularity of higher-fat diets. The unintended consequence of the saturated fat reduction was that intake of omega-6 fatty acids increased significantly. Carbohydrates, as a percentage of calories, also started to climb. To be more precise, these were intended consequences. they were unintentionally detrimental to human health. Omega-6s are a family of polyunsaturated fatty acids that are converted to highly inflammatory mediators called eicosanoids. The massive increase in the use of vegetable oils can be traced to technological advances in the 1900s that allowed modern production methods. Since corn is not naturally high in oil, normal human consumption of omega-6 oils had been quite low. But now we could process literally tons of corn in order to derive useful amounts. Omega-3 fatty acids are another family of polyunsaturated fats that are mainly anti-inflammatory. Flax seeds, walnuts, and oily fish, such as sardines and salmon, are all good sources. Omega-3 fatty acids decrease thrombosis, blood clots, and are believed to protect against heart disease. Low rates of heart disease were originally described in the Inuit population and subsequently in all major fish-eating populations. High dietary ratios of omega-6-to-3 ratios increase inflammation, potentially worsening cardiovascular disease. It is estimated that humans evolved eating a diet that is close to equal in omega-6 and 3 fatty acids. However, the current ratio in the Western diet is closer to a 15-to-1 to 30-to-1 ratio. Either we are eating way too little omega-3, way too much omega-6, or more likely both. In 1990, the Canadian nutritional guidelines were the first to recognize the important difference and include specific recommendations for both types of fatty acids. Animal fats had been replaced by highly inflammatory omega-6 laden vegetable oils that have been widely advertised as heart healthy. This is ironic since atherosclerosis is now considered mostly to be an inflammatory disease. To replace butter, Americans increasingly reached for that tub of edible plastic, margarine. With large advertising campaigns designed to play up its wholesome, all-vegetable origins, trans-fat-laden margarine was in the right place at the right time. Designed in 1869 as a cheap butter alternative, it was originally made from beef tallow and skim milk. Margarine is naturally an unappetizing white, but is dyed yellow. Butter manufacturers were not amused, and marginalized margarine for decades through tariffs and laws. Its big break came with World War II and the ensuing butter shortage. Most of the taxes and laws against margarine were repealed since butter was scarcely available anyway. This action paved the way for the great margarine renaissance of the 1960s and 70s as the war on saturated fats gained ground. Ironically, this healthier alternative, chock full of trans fats, was actually killing people. Thankfully, consumer advocacy forced the retreat of trans fats from store shelves. It's actually a minor miracle that vegetable oils were considered healthy at all. Squeezing oil from non-oily vegetables requires a substantial amount of industrial strength processing, including pressing, solvent extraction, refining, degumming, bleaching, and deodorization. There is nothing natural about margarine, and it could only have become popular during an era in which artificial equaled good. We drank artificial orange juices like Tang. We gave our children artificial baby formula. We drank artificially sweetened sodas. We made Jell-O. We thought we were smarter than Mother Nature. Whatever she had made, we could make better. Out with all natural butter, in with industrially produced artificially colored trans fat laden margarine. Out with natural animal fats, in with solvent extracted bleached and deodorized vegetable oil. What could possibly go wrong? The Diet Heart Hypothesis. In 1948, Harvard University began a decades-long community-wide prospective study of the diets and habits of the town of Framingham, Massachusetts. Every 2 years, all residents would undergo screening with blood work and questionnaires. High cholesterol levels in the blood had been associated with heart disease. But what caused this increase? A leading hypothesis was that high dietary fat was a prime factor in raising cholesterol levels. By the early 1960s, the results of the Framingham Diet Study were available. Hoping to find a definitive link between saturated fat intake, blood cholesterol, and heart disease, the study instead found nothing at all. There was absolutely no correlation. Saturated fats did not increase blood cholesterol. The study concluded no association between percent of calories from fat and serum cholesterol level was shown, nor between ratio of plant fat to animal fat intake and serum cholesterol level. Did saturated fat intake increase risk of heart disease? In a word, no. Here are the final conclusions of this forgotten jewel. There is, in short, no suggestion of any relation between diet and the subsequent development of CHD, coronary heart disease, in the study group. This negative result would be repeatedly confirmed over the next half century. No matter how hard we looked, there was no discernible relationship between dietary fat and blood cholesterol. Some trials, such as the Puerto Rico Heart Health Program, were huge, boasting more than 10,000 patients. Other trials lasted more than 20 years. The results were always the same. Saturated fat intake could not be linked to heart disease. But researchers had drunk the Kool-Aid. They believed their hypothesis so completely that they were willing to ignore the results of their own study. For example, in the widely cited Western Electric study, the authors note that the amount of saturated fatty acids in the diet was not significantly associated with the risk of death from CHD. This lack of association, however, did not dissuade the authors from concluding, "The results support the conclusion that lipid composition of the diet affects serum cholesterol concentration and risk of coronary death." All these findings should have buried the diet-heart hypothesis, but no amount of data could dissuade the diehards that dietary fat caused heart disease. Researchers saw what they wanted to see. Instead, researchers saved the hypothesis and buried the results. Despite the massive effort and expense, the Framingham Diet Study was never published in a peer-reviewed journal. Instead, results were tabulated and quietly put away in a dusty corner, which condemned us to 50 years of a low-fat future that included an epidemic of diabetes and obesity. There was also the confounding issue of the artificial trans fats. Trans fats. Saturated fats are so named because they are saturated with hydrogen. This makes them chemically stable. The polyunsaturated fats, like most vegetable oils, have holes where the hydrogen is missing. They are less stable chemically, so they have a tendency to go rancid and have a short shelf life. The solution was to create artificial trans fats. There are natural trans fats. Dairy products contain between 3% to 6% natural trans fats. Beef and lamb contain a little less than 10%. However, these natural trans fats are not believed to be harmful to human health. In 1902, Wilhelm Norman discovered that you could bubble hydrogen into vegetable oil to saturate it, turning polyunsaturated fat into saturated fat. Food labels often called this partially hydrogenated vegetable oil. Trans fat is less likely to go rancid. Trans fats are semi-solid at room temperature, so they spread easily and have an improved mouthfeel. Trans fats were ideal for deep frying. You can use this stuff over and over without changing it. Best of all, this stuff was cheap. Using leftover soybeans from animal feed, manufacturers could process the heck out of it and still get vegetable oil. A little hydrogen, a little chemistry, and boom, trans fats, baby. So what if it killed millions of people from heart disease? That knowledge was years in the future. Trans fats started to hit their stride by the 1960s, as saturated fats were fingered as the main cause of heart disease. The makers of trans fats were quick to point out that they were processed from polyunsaturated fats, the heart-healthy fat. Trans fats retained a healthy veneer, even as they were killing people left and right. Margarine, another completely artificial food, embraced trans fats like a long-lost lover. Saturated fat consumption, butter, beef, and pig fats steadily decreased. McDonald's switched from frying an unhealthy beef tallow to frying in trans fat-laden vegetable oils. Theaters switched from frying in naturally saturated coconut oil to artificially saturated trans fats. Other major sources of trans fats included deep-fried and frozen foods, packaged bakery products, crackers, vegetable shortening, and margarine. The year 1990 marked the beginning of the end for trans fat when Dutch researchers noted that consuming trans fats increased LDL, low-density lipoprotein, or bad cholesterol, and lowered HDL, high-density lipoprotein, or good cholesterol, in subjects. Closer scrutiny of the health effect led to an estimate that a 2% increase in trans fat consumption would increase risk of heart disease by a whopping 23%. By 2000, the tide had turned decisively. Most consumers were actively avoiding trans fats, and Denmark, Switzerland, and Iceland banned trans fats for human consumption. The recognition of the dangers of trans fats led to a re-evaluation of previous studies of saturated fats. Previous studies had classified trans fats together with saturated fats. Researchers strove to separate out the effect of trans fats, and that changed everything we thought we knew about saturated fats. Protective effect on heart disease and stroke. Once the skewing effect of trans fats were taken into account, the studies consistently showed that high dietary fat intake was not harmful. The enormous Nurses' Health Study followed 80,082 nurses over 14 years. After removing the effect of trans fats, this study concluded that total fat intake was not significantly related to the risk of coronary disease. Dietary cholesterol was also safe. The Swedish Malmö Diet and Cancer Study and a 2014 meta-analysis published in the Annals of Internal Medicine reached similar conclusions. And the good news for saturated fats kept rolling in. Dr. R. Krauss published a careful analysis of 21 studies covering 347,747 patients and found no significant evidence for concluding that dietary saturated fat is associated with an increased risk of CHD. In fact, there was even a small protective effect on stroke. The protective effects of saturated fats were also found in the 14-year, 58,543-person Japan Collaborative Cohort Study for Evaluation of Cancer and the 10-year Health Professionals Follow-Up Study of 43,757 men. Ironically, trans fat-laden margarines had always branded themselves as heart-healthy since they were low in saturated fat. 20-year follow-up data from the Framingham study revealed that margarine consumption was associated with more heart attacks. By contrast, eating more butter was associated with fewer heart attacks. A 10-year study in Oahu, Hawaii, found a protective effect of saturated fat on stroke risk. The 20-year follow-up data from the Framingham study confirmed these benefits. Those eating the most saturated fat had the least strokes, but polyunsaturated fats, vegetable oils, were not beneficial. Monounsaturated fats, olive oil, were also protective against stroke,